Thank you, Tom and Kelly, and thank you all for being here. So my colleagues and I work at EcoHealth Alliance, and the core of what we're doing is through a conservation framework, trying to prevent and predict pandemics, so really working upstream. So the focus of my talk will be on that today. And I do not have any financial relationships to disclose. So pandemics, when we think of them, there's a lot of fear associated with them, and rightly so. I think the media has really captured it. In the past 6 months, we've seen a lot of statements about, you know, the next pandemic, not if but when, and being prepared. And preparedness is certainly a very important part of pandemic response and pandemic preparedness. But we also need to be looking at, you know, how can we prevent them in the first place and get away from seeing them as inevitable and look at, you know, what can we do up front. So we see that there's often this very complex process that leads to disease outbreak events. So there may be a reservoir species that's unaffected by a pathogen, so it may be a really good carrier of this pathogen because it persists in the reservoir and it doesn't, it's not effective, so it can, you know, really effectively maintain that pathogen. Then it may spill over into a vector or, say, a domestic animal species that has a really high rate of contact with humans, and then it could spill over from there to humans and cause human-to-human transmission potentially. So we see that there are a lot of potential forces going on, and often we don't know the direct link when there is an outbreak. So in the case of MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome right now, we're still figuring out what the source is and how that spillover to humans is happening. So what we're trying to do is really get beyond that control focus and move towards early detection and forecasting potential pandemics so we can intervene before we get to the outbreak and the incidents in people. So what do we know? Where can we start? Well, we know that most emerging infectious diseases here on EIDs are zoonotic, so they come from animals. And this is especially the case for emerging human pathogens. So the focus of my talk will be on pathogens from wildlife, but I'd like to note that many of these approaches can also be applied to other sources of EIDs, such as zoonotic non-wildlife sources. And it's important to note that these diseases are really dynamic, so they may be emerging and really persist for a short time and ideally die out, or they may become endemic or enzootic. So for the case of rabies, you know, that was originally an emerging disease, and now it's become widespread and endemic in many regions. We're also seeing that the rate of disease emergence is increasing, and this is not just because of better reporting and detection, although, you know, we've made a lot of gains there, but actually the number of EIDs is thought to be increasing per year, and I think yesterday there was in another presentation, it was cited that 3 to 5 new EIDs per year were emerging, so that's pretty substantial. So where are these coming from? You know, who is transmitting these? So here in the graph, we see that the blue lines are total number of new viruses shared with humans. So the main two, the first two, are pans, so chimpanzees, and then ovis, so sheep. So then we've also adjusted this for sampling effort. So those are the green lines. And when we look at that, we see that there are 3 taxa that you know, are really leading to these spillovers, and those are bats, non-human primates, and rodents. So that we reason that from this, we, you know, if we look more at these taxa, we may find a lot of potential viruses that could spill over. So how does this spillover happen? Well, there are biological traits that influence infectivity and pathogenicity. These are reservoir species, host and intermediate host species, and then also traits such as receptors, which allow a pathogen or do not allow a pathogen to be infectious to another species. And then R0, so that's the potential to replicate, and if it's less than 1, it'll die out in a population, and if it's greater than 1, it could cause an ongoing outbreak. And then we're seeing that there are these interfaces, and these allow for human wildlife contact opportunities. So I'll talk more on this in the following slides, but just to start to think about it, these are behaviors such as extractive industries, ecotourism, markets, where we're seeing that contact. So we're also seeing the where of EIDs. And Kelly, thank you. You mentioned the hotspots modeling and mapping, and that's essentially what this is. So we're showing the relative risk of a new zoonotic EID from wildlife. This is based on a data set from the peer-reviewed literature of emergence events from 1940 to 2004. And emergence events are defined here as a changing event or a first emergence or increasing in scale. So we can start to see where these have happened and where they're likely to occur again. So the green is where there's, no risk or a low risk. The red is where we've seen a lot of outbreaks before. So we see that, India, certain parts of India are really, really red. Certain parts of the U.S. as well, so New York and a lot of other ports where we may have a lot of constant travel. So we can start to focus down and target our surveillance and control efforts. And I want to note that this is a global model, and it's really helpful, but we can also do this at a country level, and now we're getting down to the 5 kilometer and 1 kilometer level, so we can start to really focus our efforts. So then the why of EIDs, and I think this is really the core of it. So we're seeing that there are drivers of disease emergence, and there are broad drivers, and land use change leads them, and then intensive agriculture and food industry. We've seen a lot of changes there recently, and bushmeat hunting, climate change, so these are really broad drivers. And we can also look at these on a country level because they are so broad. So, it's helpful to see from a global scale, but we can also look at them more in a more targeted fashion. And these are really human-mediated. So when we're seeing why are EIDs occurring, well, it's because of our global practices that are really bringing this to emerge. So let's look at a specific example. The extractive industries are one of the leading ones through land use change, and these include industries such as timber extraction, oil and gas, mining, and plantation. So these can be happening on really large scales or really small scales. So we can have artisanal, gold extraction or really large scale, say, oil extraction. And they create a lot of ecological changes. So we'll install roads and other corridors to access these often really remote natural resources. There's usually an influx of workers, and then they have protein needs. So there's a great increase in bushmeat consumption often. And these areas that are targeted for natural resources are often in those hot spots for disease emergence. These are often tropical developing countries with poor public health and other infrastructure, and they often have high wildlife diversity. Often in these projects, there are no upfront health risk assessments for local communities. So right there we see, wow, here's an opportunity where we can be a little more proactive and look at the risks ahead of time. So given what we know so far about EIDs, USAID's Emerging Pandemic Threats Program released a series of projects 4 years ago to start to build capacity in those hotspot countries. So the PREDICT program is looking at creating disease surveillance in wildlife. The RESPOND program is working on building up capacity through One Health networks and working with universities to identify and respond to disease outbreaks. The IDENTIFY project is focusing on diagnostic capacities, and the PREVENT project is working on characterizing those high-risk interfaces, those practices, which increase the potential for disease risks, and working to formulate behavior change. So I'd like to focus in on the PREDICT project that I've been working on. This is a collaboration led by UC Davis with partners from EcoHealth Alliance, Wildlife Conservation Society, Metabiota, and the Smithsonian Institution. So we're conducting surveillance in wildlife in 20-plus hotspot countries around the world, and we're focusing on those priority taxa that we saw earlier, so the bats, non-human primates, and rodents. And we're collecting samples through non-lethal practices, and currently we have over 200,000 samples. So I'd like to focus on what the objectives are and then now what we're doing with those samples. So the overall objectives of the five-year program are to identify new pathogens in wildlife, so novel ones that we haven't seen before, and ideally before they can emerge in people. Then we're creating global risk maps for the next pandemic, so refining those hotspots models, getting them more locally oriented, and then ideally reducing the spread of new pathogens. So to do this, we're repeatedly sampling and testing for 25-plus viral families. And we can start to generate these viral discovery curves. So the y-axis here is viral species. The x-axis is number of samples. And this is an example for a specific species, the Indian flying fox. And we can see that with sampling effort, as it increases, we see more viruses. So we're finding more viruses. But at a certain point, it plateaus. And we can start to see that we've captured the majority of viruses. And then we can actually generate an estimate of the number of viruses. So for in this case, it's 58, and we would need about 7,000 samples to find all of those viruses in this one species. And this is on a country level, I should note. So we can see that, wow, you know, this requires a lot of sampling, but there's not an infinite number of viruses out there, and we can be a little more strategic and targeted in our sampling and testing. Then we can also start to look at those changing dynamics. So climate change, we know it has a lot of impacts that are yet to be seen. So we can actually map out the potential changes based on climate conditions on host range. So in this case, the Turopis bat is the reservoir for Nipah virus, which has emerged in Malaysia and Bangladesh. And it's really a serious concern, and it's highly fatal, so we don't want to, you know, see it around the world. But this is an optimistic scenario for climate change, so showing some minimal changes in climatic conditions. And the green is where there's likely to be very little climate change. And then the red is where there may be a more hospitable condition for this specific host species. So we can see that potentially in 2050, with these given, you know, what-if scenario for climate change, there may be some spread of this host. And we note the risk for southwestern U.S. So we can start to work upfront to prevent the transmission in these new areas that are hospitable for the host species. We're also seeing a tremendous source of information going into digital surveillance. So we may be familiar with ProMed Mail and HealthMap, and these are great tools that allow us to track really timely disease emergence and interpret it, and then hopefully pair that with on-the-ground efforts to aid in early detection. It's also really cool because we can also see where there's outbreaks in animals and use these as potential sentinels for humans. Flu near you is great because it's using the public knowledge. We're, you know, sourcing, we're getting biosurveillance through the public, so it's really engaging them through a public health approach. And then all of these approaches have involved benefits from other sectors. So working with ecologists, we can refine our knowledge of pathogen host human behavior, working with evolutionary biologists, looking at recombination potential, development of antimicrobial resistance, working with economists to develop cost-effective approaches, and working, say, with conservationists to look at animals as sentinels. So there's a lot of other sectors that we can begin to engage and really benefit from. Where is the payoff of all of this? So we know that preventing pandemics can save a lot of, you know, human lives, and also prevent potential endemic establishment. It prevents the disruption of the social function, so preventing disruptions in trade and travel. And also, pandemics are proving to be very expensive. So just at one given pandemic, SARS was estimated at a cost of $30 to $50 billion to the global economy. So that's a lot of money. So what is the cost of prevention? Well, there was a recent study published, I think in September, that looked at the cost of yearly surveillance for viral discovery to detect the majority of viruses circulating. And it was deemed to be an estimated cost of $1.4 billion per year for 10 years. That's still a lot of money, but it's a fraction of the cost of just, as we see, one outbreak. And then these, you know, we can really generate cost-effective One Health solutions. And in the case of rabies, we've seen that control across domestic animals, humans, and wildlife may be really cost-effective. So in summary, when we look at predicting and preventing pandemics, there's some information that we know we have already and then other information that we can work to generate. So on disease emergence, what practices generate risk? And then where are diseases likely to emerge? So those hotspots models, hotspots maps. What conditions are necessary for emergence? So what drivers are we seeing and where can we manage those risks? And then how can we best prevent, control, and mitigate those risks? And then also pairing that with capacity for pandemic preparedness upstream. So how do we engage other sectors, get them involved, building strong infrastructure for surveillance and coordinated response along that human-animal environment interface. Of course, using novel diagnostic approaches, and we're seeing a lot of really exciting approaches where we can find, you know, new viruses, and it's really revolutionizing our detection. And then also anticipating the growing environmental pressures and cost of pandemics and trying to see ahead of time what we might do to minimize those growing risks. And the goal then is to detect novel pathogens before they spread. So with that, I thank our collaborators and I thank you all very much and I'd be happy for questions after.
Yes,
thank you. Thank you.
Our last presentation this morning is from Dr. Kelly Patrick. Again, for those that came in later, Kelly is a veterinarian for the USDA APHIS. She has a DVM from Colorado State and an MPH from the University of Colorado.
Thank you.
Plug in to who's more proficient at man? Oh, did I step on it?
Oh, this looks...
Oh, I see.
Oops.
There we go. That helped.
We were halfway there.
Yeah.